History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Greetings, everyone. Welcome back to our series, Key Battles of World War I. In the last few episodes, we were looking at the terrible year of 1916, the Battle of the Somme, the battles in the South. But there's a sense among different armies that a breakthrough could happen. The British, the Germans are innovating their tactics. They're incorporating tanks and other things that can get across no man's land, how to use infantry and couple it with foot soldiers and their artillery together. But we're going to pause on that for a second, and we're going to look at something else, which, I don't know, I think arguably could be the most significant and longest-lasting effect of World War I, and that is the Russian Revolutions. That's at least my vote for something that's had the longest legacy as a result of World War I. Do you think there's anything to that, James?
Oh, I agree with you. It would definitely be the make the top two or three, if not the top one. It's hugely significant. I mean, it's going to cast a shadow over the entire rest of the 20th century and really even further than that.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've touched on that, especially at the beginning of this series, how the Great War, it's this watershed between the pre-modern era and the early modern. And historians will slice that up all sorts of different ways. So don't take that as the definitive account. But if you think about Russia, it really is a watershed, because before the Great War, Russia is an autocracy. It's very conservative, very religious. They're only a few decades away from serfdom. So there are people in Russia who have a living memory of an institution that died out in most of the rest of Europe in the Middle Ages. But after the war, after the Great War, Russia is officially communist, atheistic. It's rapidly industrializing. It's becoming one of the two superpowers that dominate the 20th century. And its effects live on in the 21st century. I lived in Hungary for a couple of years, and I met many people who lived through the Soviet period, and they did not have fond memories of that. What did the Serbs think of the Soviet period? I'm curious, James, since they weren't with NATO or the Warsaw Pact, if I have that right.
Well, yeah, they were distinct, actually. Yugoslavia was, they kind of charted their own path as far as the whole communist thing. They broke away from the Soviets in 1948, and you know, the Soviets just didn't think they were worth invading like they did some of the other countries. But most of the Serbs I spoke to, well, there were some that kind of looked nostalgically back to Tito, because Tito had the communist leader of Yugoslavia, Tito, who ruled until 1980 when he passed away. He kept the country together, and things were fairly decent for most people. Most people had a fairly decent standard of living, much better than that in most communist countries. But of course, their freedoms were extremely limited. People tend to forget that. They tend to look back and focus on the fact that most people had jobs and health care and things like that. But I would say most the Serbs that I met did not have a favorable view of the Soviet Union, for sure.
And it's interesting how in different accounts, you'll have a totally different take on the exact same historical events that are happening. And before we kick off this narrative, I found a couple of quotes that I love how sharply they diverge. One is by Alexandra Kollontai, who wrote an autobiography in the 1920s. And she said, "Looking back, one perceives only a massive operation, struggle, in action. In reality, there were no heroes or leaders. It was the people, the working people in soldiers' uniform or in civilian attire, who controlled the situation and who will record its will indelibly in the history of the country and mankind. It was a sultry summer, a crucial summer of the revolutionary flood tide in 1917. So the bloom has not come off the rose, even the 1920s. Now, Winston Churchill had a slightly different account on the Soviet revolution. He said basically that the Bolsheviks were a greater threat to Europe than what he called the reeking tube and iron shard of the Kaiser's Reich. He told the House of Commons that Bolshevism was not a policy, it is a disease. It is not a creed, it is a pestilence. The Germans have smuggled Bolshevik leader Vladimir Lenin into Russia in the same way that you might send a file containing a culture of typhoid or of cholera to be poured into the water supply of a great city. And it worked with amazing accuracy. So that Churchill, always good for a quote, right?
Churchill has a way with words. I'll tell you what, he did not have ever anything good to say about the Soviet Union. I tell you what.
Yeah, and it makes his meeting with Stalin all the more interesting later on. But hey, let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. We got a lot to bite off. So kick it off, James. What's the background of the Russian revolutions?
Okay, way back in our first episode, we talked about what, gave a brief overview of what things were like in Russia. It was a monarchy, obviously it was an autocracy. The Tsar or emperor had all the power. The last Russian Tsar, as we mentioned previously, was Nicholas II. He came to the throne in 1894 as a relatively young man. And Nicholas was not well suited to be an absolute ruler. You know, Dan Carlin talks about how when you have an autocracy, it's kind of the luck of the draw. You're rolling the dice in the gene pool. And sometimes you get strong rulers and good rulers, like, say, Peter the Great, Catherine the Great, although you could definitely debate whether or not they were good rulers, but they were effective at least. And then sometimes you get really bad ones. Nicholas was kind of in the middle. He was just a mediocrity. He did care deeply about doing his job, so to speak, well, but he was a man of very modest abilities, kind of like Kaiser Wilhelm II. Runs in the family, right, Scott?
They are cousins. Yeah.
In 1905, there had been a revolution in Russia, or at least an attempted revolution. However, this one didn't work. Nicholas was almost overthrown, but he put the revolution down brutally, and he left a lot of bad blood behind, even though he held on to power. After the 1905 revolution, Soviets were formed and spread throughout the countryside. Now, I should say that the original definition of Soviet is just a council. It's just it's a meeting. It's an ongoing meeting, a group of people who meet together. And they were formed to give people a chance to discuss issues and have a voice in local government. And one of the leaders of the Soviets that rose to prominence was Leon Trotsky. We'll talk about him much more later. The revolution of 1905 prompted Nicholas to allow the formation of the Duma, which was the Russian parliament. But he later undermined its functioning at every turn. And as a result, the Duma ends up with very little power. It's just really ceremonial more than anything else. From 1907 to 1911, reforms were introduced in Russia. But at the same time, revolutionary movements were forming. And some of these were peasant movements. One of the most significant peasant movements, it wasn't really strictly a peasant movement. The leaders of it were educated people from the middle and lower middle classes, but it was called the Marxist Social Democrats, and they modeled themselves after similar movements in Europe, Social Democrats, except that they held to the teachings of Karl Marx. And within the Social Democrats, you had two major divisions, Mensheviks and Bolsheviks, and Bolsheviks gave themselves that name, which the word Bolshevik means majority. That's misleading, though, because they were actually the minority. But the Bolsheviks, the most important thing we need to know is that the Bolsheviks were the most radical wing of the Social Democrats. Now, during the Great War, as we've seen, the Russian army has had a few victories, but for the most part, they've suffered disaster after disaster. And these disasters greatly undermined Russian morale and loyalty to the government. Discipline broke down as many Russian soldiers voted with their feet, meaning they deserted. Entire Russian armies just disintegrated because the people just left. The soldiers walked away. Many Russians were scandalized by one of the key advisors to Tsar Nicholas and his wife, Alexandra. And this was the quasi-monk Grigory Rasputin. Rasputin was, he was a piece of work, wasn't he, Scott?
Yeah, hard to kill also.
Yeah, he was hard to kill. He was a man who called himself a monk, and he dressed like a monk. He wore a black cassock, and he had a big long beard and long hair like Orthodox monks traditionally do, but he was definitely not Orthodox in any sense of the word. He was very unorthodox, but he called himself a faith healer. He had a reputation of being someone who could heal diseases, and the Tsar and his wife had a son who was a hemophiliac, and for whatever reason, and nobody can explain it to this day, Rasputin seemed to actually be able to make him better. Because of this, he had a great influence over the Tsar and Tsarina, especially the Tsarina Alexandra. But Rasputin was also very sexually immoral and a big drinker. He did not live a holy life by any stretch of the imagination. So many people in Russian society and as well as in the government were greatly offended by him and wanted him gone. But Tsar Nicholas and his wife just loved him, so they kept him around. Scott, you had some more to add about this.
Yeah, I just, an aside, there have been a lot of Rasputins in history. Whenever you have a court, there are always quacks who will enter it. And all they really have to do is convince their patron that they're worthwhile, even if everyone else detests them or thinks they're ridiculous. Many sultans of the Ottoman Empire had quacks. One for Ibrahim the Mad. He was a man who claimed he could exorcise demons and told the sultan that, hey, whatever enters your mind, God put it there, so just do whatever you want. And yeah, you can find a lot of those. But another thing that explains Tsarina Alexandra's lack of popularity is that she's German-born. There's an idea that she's not loyal to the people. All these German-born royals ruling other people in European history, the House of Hanover and Britain, although they end up a little better. So that's one factor, too. And there's all sorts of other things having to do with Russia. Nicholas wasn't an able ruler. He also was ruling at a time, it was hard for everyone during World War One, but especially for Russia, it's rapidly industrializing. There's urban overcrowding. There's poor conditions for urban industrial workers. The population is growing like crazy in St. Petersburg. So there aren't good social services for people. They don't really trust the Tsarist regime anyway. 1904, it's found that there's an average of 16 people sharing each apartment with 6 people per room. If you imagine like a Dostoevsky novel where it seems like everyone is in filth and poverty, that's what it's like. And then it's all this tinder put together. Then when the match strikes with World War One, you have conscription swallowing up huge amounts of Russia. Then skilled workers are leaving the cities. Factories are replaced with unskilled workers that are maybe more open to a revolution. They don't have as much to lose. A lot of difficulty going on. So that's some of the context there.
Russia was a mess. It really was. And it's a miracle, maybe not a miracle, that may be too strong of a word, but it's surprising that the monarchy held on as long as it did. But eventually it didn't. So that's what we're going to talk about next. By the way, just to close the book on Rasputin, he's a fascinating character, and I strongly suggest that our listeners do some extra reading about him. We don't have time to go into a lot of detail about him right now, but they finally, some of the, I believe they were nobles in the court, or I can't remember exactly who it was, Scott, but a group of people got together and tried to kill him, and he kept surviving. They kept failing, and finally he was assassinated. But anyway, kind of a sad story overall and how much influence he had over the government, but we don't have time for more. Let's move on. We're going to move on to March of 1917, and the Russians at the time said it was February because they were under the old calendar, the Julian calendar, which the Russian government followed and the Russian nation. Today, the Russian Orthodox Church still does, but the nation of Russia doesn't. So in March of 1917, in St. Petersburg, or Petrograd as it was called, before the war, the Russian capital was called St. Petersburg, and then when the war broke out, they decided that sounded too German, so they called it Petrograd. Later, it will be renamed as Leningrad, not to give away too much here, but but this revolution broke out more or less spontaneously, and it took everyone by surprise. On March 8th, which is my birthday, but it's also the International Day of Women in Europe, women workers began crying out for food in the streets. They were soon joined by striking workers from the local armaments factory. So things are getting out of hand. There are riots in the streets. The city garrison was ordered to fire upon the crowd, but they refused. And instead, they joined the rebels. And the crowd continued to grow. Most members of the Duma joined the protest. So that's always a bad sign, Scott, when the government sends out the police to shut down a riot, and instead they join the riot. It's like, you guys are not doing your job.
Yeah, now it's recourse after that. Your personal bodyguards? Not a lot else.
Yeah, I mean, what are you going to do? The clock is running out for Nicholas. And sure enough, on March 15th, Tsar Nicholas II abdicated. He stepped down and gave up power. And this ended 3 centuries of Romanov rule. David Lloyd George, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, or the UK, actually technically offered him sanctuary. But King George V countermanded that. And that shows that the monarch at this time was not completely powerless, wasn't just a figurehead like they are today. They still had a little bit of power, not much, but some. But that's really kind of sad, Scott, don't you think? King George, I mean, he was his relative, but he wouldn't let him in the country. Just think of what might have happened if King George had allowed Nicholas and Alexander and their children to relocate to England. At the very least, they would have lived. But it's kind of a sad story, I think. By mid-March, several former Duma members formed a provisional government. Their goal was to make Russia a republic. They wanted to be a democratic republic. But unfortunately for them, their rule was ineffective. The leader of the provisional government was a man named Alexander Kerensky, who was also war minister. Just, he wasn't able to keep a lid on the tensions. Things had just gone too far. The people were fed up, and a lot of people felt like this was just not good enough, this idea of a democratic republic. They wanted radical change. And I should say also that one of Kerensky's mistakes, and this is what made so many people not want to follow him, was that he insisted that Russia stay in the war, whereas the Bolsheviks and the Soviets were saying, let's get out of the war as soon as possible. And that really struck a chord with a lot of the average Russian people, because the Russians were absolutely fed up with the war. The soldiers were tired of suffering and fighting and getting wounded and dying. The people back home were tired of losing their sons and their husbands and their brothers and all that. So Kerensky made a huge mistake by insisting that Russia stay in the war and honor their treaty obligations to the Allied powers.
Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
The provisional government, as I've already hinted, was not accepted everywhere. It had several rivals, and the most significant of these were the Soviets, the councils, these local quasi-governmental bodies, especially the Petrograd Soviet. The provisional government tolerated the Petrograd Soviet, but they kept a wary eye on it. And really, for a while, at least, they're going to kind of share power with the Petrograd Soviet in a very awkward situation, if you will.
So there's a little bit of a custody battle going on with these different governments. And I just want to mention one thing before we get too far in the rise of the Bolsheviks. And when we hear that now, we think from our perspective of all the failed socialistic uprisings in the 20th century, from the Soviet Union onto Cuba into Venezuela, and they normally end up in tin pot dictatorships. And I think a lot of us would sort of laugh. I'm guessing you would, James, when someone would say, well, socialism works. That wasn't real socialism. Socialism hasn't been tried yet. And you think, okay, like how many more times? But right. I did an episode recently on a woman named Martha Dodd, who was a spy for the Soviets. She was an American, but she was working to support communism. This was in the early 20th century. And some of the works I read made the point that, especially then, socialism and communism had a viability because there were many people that really were marginalized by rapidly industrializing nations. This is an age of robber barons. There's not much of a social safety net. You don't have union rules. You're working 14 hours a day. In America, what's really protecting you? Maybe a machine boss, maybe a Tammany Hall or something like that, where if you're lucky enough to be in a quasi-illegal spoil system, you can have some type of protection, or almost the mafia. But the democratic or capitalist governments can really marginalize you. So all that to say, when people are desperate, I think just putting them in the context of the time, I don't want it to seem like, oh, everyone went crazy in Russia and they cast their lot with the system that would doom them to gulags and triggered famines and all that. So just wanted to mention that before we get too far into the Bolsheviks.
All right. Yeah, good stuff. So we've had one revolution, the March Revolution. This is the one a lot of people don't know about. Of course, all of our listeners are serious history buffs, right, Scott? So they're
absolutely
already going to know
about
that.
They wouldn't be here. But we would have scared them off by now.
That's right. Not. But yeah, they wouldn't be sticking out a multi-part series like this. But of course, the March Revolution is not going to be the one that takes. The one that is going to end up being permanent and taking control for a very long time of Russia is going to be the Bolshevik Revolution. So let's give a little background on the Bolsheviks. We'll start by discussing the central figure of the Bolshevik Revolution, and that is a man named Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, who took on the name of Lenin. Thank you, sir. That was it's much easier to pronounce. But so Vladimir Lenin was one of the most radical revolutionaries. He had been won over to the cause of Marxism a long time ago as a young man. He had a brother that was brutally murdered by the authorities back in the late 1800s, and that helped radicalize Lenin. Lenin had been thrown out of the country by the Russian government. He had been in Switzerland, but this is very interesting. And that quote you gave from Churchill earlier is, I think, is very fitting, because the German government in April of 1917 realized, hey, you know, one way we could defeat Russia, other than defeating them on the battlefield, which has been up to that point was seemed to be almost impossible to do, based on, if nothing else, the massive numbers of Russian soldiers. They just had so many. They said, let's try to defeat them politically instead. Let's send them Lenin. That will be like
the virus.
Right, a virus. It's like putting a virus in there. So they thought, if we can send Lenin over there, Lenin will stir up trouble, possibly even bring down the government, and then that'll be the end of the war in the East. It's a pretty good move on their part. They sent Lenin from Switzerland to St. Petersburg in a train. Now, some sources say it was a sealed train, meaning nobody could get in or out and nobody knew who was in it. Other sources say it was not a sealed train. One of my major sources for this series was Vejas Gabriel Lelouvichus. Forgive me, sir, if I pronounced your name wrong. He's a professor at, I think, the University of Tennessee, an expert on Eastern European history. He said it was not a sealed train, but it doesn't really matter. What does matter is he did arrive safely in Petrograd. And as soon as Lenin arrived there in the capital, he immediately began giving revolutionary speeches. He gave a famous series of speeches called the April Theses. And these messages promised that with a further radical revolution, peace, land, and all power to the Soviets would become a revolutionary goal, and it would be achieved. In other words, he's promising people work and bread and peace and land and all that stuff, you know, the same thing that communists always promise. So we'll see how that works out later. Actually, that'll probably be another series, Scott. But anyway, Lenin called for the overthrow of the provisional government. He said this provisional government led by Kerensky that wanted a democratic republic, that's not good enough. That's not going to cut it. He wanted to be overthrown and replaced by government by the Soviets. And ironically, for Lenin and his followers, the worse things got in Russia, the better. It seems kind of like an oxymoron. The worse things are, the better. But if you think about it, if people got more and more hungry, more and more desperate, if the war went worse and worse, they would be a lot more open to hear a message of radical change, the message that he and his followers were bringing. His message was shocking to many, but over time he won many to his position. He said defeat in the war is necessary. It's a good thing. We need to lose the war so we can focus on gaining control and bringing revolution, true revolution, he would say, to Russia. One of the converts to the Bolshevik movement was Leon Trotsky. Trotsky was originally a Menshevik, the faction of the communists who were not quite as radical, and they were opposed to the Bolsheviks. So Trotsky and Lenin were originally political enemies, but then Trotsky had a change of heart and joined forces with Lenin. He kind of becomes Lenin's right-hand man and a great asset to him. Lenin, the Bolsheviks, they kind of jumped the gun a little. They tried to seize power in July, only 4 months after the first revolution, but they failed. Lenin fled to Finland, but he continued plotting. That brings us up to October/November, depending on which calendar you're on. Do you have any thoughts on that, Scott, on the prelude to the November Revolution?
Well, first of all, good for, if nothing else, the revolution brought the Gregorian calendar. I think I read somewhere that the first Olympics, the Russians showed up late because they were using the Julian calendar. So those discrepancies will get you. And I had to learn the Islamic calendar when I was doing the Ottoman Empire, so it's tricky. This is an interesting factor, too, where the worse things get, it's better for them over time. And you have the Mensheviks and the Bolsheviks. This echoes, for those who study the French Revolution, there are different factions. And the original faction, which goes against the aristocracy, is eventually liquidated by a much more radical faction. So at the end of it, you get a Robespierre, and it's sort of a race to the bottom of radicalism. So it's an interesting echo of that. That's all I really have to say there.
Yeah, there's not the idea, oh, you know, we'll win you over by persuasion and we'll just talk and persuade you and you'll be all decide to become Bolsheviks. No, that's not Lenin's style. Lenin's style is you agree with me or you die. It's very simple. In fact, I heard a quote and I can't remember what my source was on this. Hopefully it's an accurate quote. Maybe it may be one of those urban legend, made up quotes kind of thing. But supposedly someone said something to Lenin about it was somebody from the West, and they said, we have freedom of speech in our country, but you don't. And Lenin said, well, you do have the freedom to speak and to say whatever you want, but in my country, but I also have the freedom to shoot you for it.
Freedom he exercised with great liberality.
Yeah, very different take on freedom. But all right, let's move into November or October. It's October on the old calendar, November in the new calendar. By October, the Bolsheviks saw that the time was ripe. And on November 7th, new calendar, they seized power. Red Guard forces, these were the shock troops of the Bolsheviks. They stormed the Winter Palace, where the provisional government was housed. The Red Guard seized control of the palace and arrested the members of the government. They announced that they were seizing control not for themselves, but on behalf of the Soviets. Yeah, right. But anyway.
How kind of them. How selfless.
Yeah. I mean, nobody ever says, hey, I'm seizing control and I'm going to make myself dictatorship. Dictator, you know, at least not in recent history. They say, oh, I'm seizing power on behalf of the people or the councils or whatever. But anyway, sorry if I sound cynical, people. But in reality.
It's fair.
Yeah.
With the Soviets,
we've
I think
got 100
fair.
Years of hindsight to work with here. In reality, true power was held by the Council of People's Commissars, which was a select steering committee led by Lenin. So a very small group of people. It was really an oligarchy at this point. The state gradually took over ownership of land, although they allowed and encouraged peasants to occupy it. And, of course, not everybody wanted to be a Bolshevik. Not everybody wanted the country to be controlled by Bolsheviks. So how did the Bolsheviks deal with that? On December 17th, 1917, they formed an organization with a very long official name, so get ready for this. It was called the All-Russian Extraordinary or Emergency Commission for Combating Counter-Revolution and Sabotage under the Council of People's Commissars of the RSFSR. And the short version for that, the abbreviation in Russian, is the Cheka. The Cheka becomes infamous as they're the secret police, basically. They're the kind of like the grandfather organization of the KGB. Later on, you're going to have another organization called the NKVD, which is kind of the father of the KGB. But this is the mechanism by which Lenin and the Bolsheviks really gained complete control over the state. Their job was to carry out red terror, so-called red terror, red being the traditional color of communism. They brutalized, imprisoned, or killed non-Bolsheviks and other so-called enemies of the state. And one by one, rival political groups were shut down, even other socialist groups. If you were just a kind of a moderate socialist or even a communist, but not a Bolshevik, that's not good enough. You have to go. The state took control of factories, internal trade, and land. And in elections for a constituent assembly, which was going to kind of be like a Duma, but with some actual power, it had been called by the provisional government before the communist takeover. In these elections for the constituent assembly, the Bolsheviks received only 25% of the vote. What do you do in this situation if you're a Bolshevik? Oh, it's quite simple. You nullify the elections and you shut down the assembly. You just sweep it away. On July, and then the Tsar had been taken prisoner and his family. And tragically, on July 16th, 1918, the Bolsheviks executed Tsar Nicholas and his family in Yekaterinburg. And interestingly enough, the Russian Orthodox Church canonized the entire family as saints. And this has been probably 5 or 6 years, maybe even 10 years. I can't remember. Time goes by so fast. But anyway, they were given saint status because of their martyrdom. Lenin announced that for now, a dictatorship was needed. Yeah, for now.
Just temporarily until return to full democracy.
For a little while, he said dictatorship was, this is his quote, authority untrammeled by any laws, absolutely unrestricted by any rules whatever, and based directly on force.
Well, he's telling the truth right there.
Yeah, at least he's honest, right? He's not trying to sugarcoat it here. Lenin and his followers expected communist revolutions to break out in other nations soon after the Russian Revolution. And to help promote this, they published all the secret treaties made between Russia and the other European powers. We've mentioned a few of these. A lot of treaties had been made in secret, and once they were published, it was very embarrassing to the Western powers as well as the former Russian government. things like, oh, well, let's just divide up the Ottoman Empire and let's just carve it up into pieces. Russia gets this part. France gets this part. Britain gets this part. It just doesn't look good. That's why they kept them secret in the first place. So that is basically what happened. It's very brief. We kind of flew through things. We're just hitting the highlights like we always do. But it's a very complicated story of the two revolutions with a lot of moving parts. But we end up with no more Russia. No, I mean, Russia, yes, but now it's moving in the direction of becoming the Soviet Union.
Hey, everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Well, that's really interesting. I didn't get a chance to follow this up before the recording of this episode, but the point being that they publish all the secret treaties between Russia and other European powers, plans for after the war. What typically happens is that for a number of years, documents are classified and then they're declassified. Sometimes you have to do a Freedom of Information Act. In the case of the United States, there are still documents related to World War II, top secret missions that have not yet been released. Now, there are leaks. There's WikiLeaks. There's Edward Snowden and other things like that. Intelligence that comes out if we're talking about the war on terror and other things. But yeah, I wonder if this is the first example like this where incredible intelligence is leaked that immediately affects during the course of the war how people are going to act. I mean, I wonder if there would have been the same sort of impetus for revolutionary movements in the Middle East, for example, if they didn't know what the full intentions of Europe were. Maybe Ataturk wouldn't have been so ready to risk it all to have an independent Turkish Republic. A lot of counterfactuals, but I think that's a really interesting factor here that is not something that you hear often, but when we understand how intelligence like this can shift popular opinion, something to think about how that changed the course of events.
Yeah, it really is. I think it certainly revealed the cynicism, meaning like cynicism in the sense of, I don't know, it's realpolitik. It shows how the things that the Western powers, Britain and France especially, the things they said didn't always match up with their actions. You know, they talked about freedom and democracy and things like that, but and self-government, on behalf of the peoples, but they weren't really all that interested in that. They were above all else interested in their own power.
Yeah, I mean, you could make up plenty of propaganda posters with Germany like a giant ape violating a symbol of liberty, but there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah, the British and French love to say, well, we're the good guys and the Germans are the bad guys. So we don't want to let you know that we're going to take over Syria and Palestine and Lebanon and, you know, all those other parts of the Middle East. And we're going to give Constantinople to the Russians and so on. Of course, that's going to end up not happening. But anyway, we could talk all day about this. Let's wrap up by talking about the next thing that happens. And this has a huge impact on the war. That is, the Russians are going to leave the war. So we'll talk about the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. Soon after taking power, the Bolsheviks announced that Russia was leaving the war. This obviously is a great blow to the Western allies. You're going to do what? Wait a minute. What about the Triple Entente? Well, okay, that was the Tsar who signed that with you. There's a new sheriff in town now, and we're not going to follow the rules that the old Russia followed. So on December 15th, Russia signed a ceasefire with the Central Powers. And Lenin believed that Russia had to accept defeat in the war and even the loss of territory in order to be able to consolidate the revolution in Russia and eventually promote worldwide revolution. It was more important to him to make sure he gained full control over Russia than it was to win the war. And anyway, on December 22nd, German and Russian diplomats met at the former Russian fortress of Brest-Litovsk. The Bolsheviks were led by Adolf Joffre, not to be confused with Joseph Joffre, who was the French general. This Joffre, in late December, he wasn't really doing a very good job, so he was replaced by Leon Trotsky. And in the negotiations, the Soviets, they love to make speeches. They were not just speaking to the Germans, they were speaking to the world, and they were hoping to inspire revolutions around the world. They were stalling for time. So they just kept stalling and kind of marking time and sandbagging the Germans. And eventually the negotiations reach a deadlock. But first, I want to mention in passing, Lenin back in Petrograd is almost assassinated. A couple of Russian army soldiers tried to assassinate him unsuccessfully, although the assassination attempts on Lenin are going to have long-term effects on his health. More on that another time. Okay, so as I mentioned, the negotiations between the Russians and the Germans at Brest-Litovsk reached a deadlock, and Trotsky just got up and walked out. So goodbye, sorry. He was saying my way or the highway. But the Germans then said, no, 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 our way or the highway. They issued an ultimatum. They said, sign the treaty proposed by Germany or face further invasion. The Germans had already taken over quite a bit of Russian territory. And then they decided, well, maybe we can persuade them by taking even more Russian territory. So they went on the offensive. They launched.
I love this name. Oh, yeah, I love this name.
Operation Faustschlag, which is fist punch. I like that. Yeah.
Sounds like a direct-to-video Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, Operation Fist Punch.
Yeah, it does. Like, yeah. Pow. So the German army quickly marched eastward. They met no resistance. They came within 100 miles of Petrograd. The German general Max Hoffmann, one of their best generals, wrote this. He said, quote, it was the most comical war I have ever known. We put a handful of infantrymen with machine guns and one gun, meaning one large artillery piece, onto a train and rush them off to the next station. They take it, make prisoners of the Bolsheviks, pick up a few more troops, and so on. This proceeding has, at my rate, the charm of novelty. So it's kind of like, hey, we're having fun now.
Nothing's ever moving so fast.
Yeah, we've never moved this fast before. There's no Russians to oppose us. That quote is from John Keegan's work, The First World War, by the way. Good solid overview. Not the most exciting read, but solid nonetheless. So here come the Germans. They're getting uncomfortably close to Petrograd. Lenin convinced Trotsky, you know, he said, you might want to go back and just sign the treaty or there's not going to be any more Russian government. We're gonna get captured by the Germans and get killed. No matter how harsh it is, just go sign it. The alternative might be an even harsher treaty. So he did. Trotsky went back, and on March 3rd, the Bolshevik negotiator signed the treaty, and it was very harsh on Russia. You know, Scott, the Treaty of Versailles, which we'll talk about in a future episode, was a very harsh treaty on Germany, but it was nothing compared to this one. This is way more harsh than what the Germans are going to have to submit to later. Under the treaty, just as examples, Russia lost one-third of its territory. One-third. And Russia's huge, right? One-third of Russia is like more than some continents, right? One-fourth of its population, 75% of its coal and iron. That really hurt. And it lost its most industrialized areas. It lost Finland, the Baltic states, Ukraine, Belorussia, and Poland. Germany, though, had to deploy 1 million soldiers to occupy the territory. That's the downside of it. Germany's going to get all this territory. Some of these places become independent. Some of them fall under German control. But if they're going to be under German control, Germany's got to control them, right? So it takes 1 million soldiers. And this really, it's a mixed blessing, Scott, because even though Germany wasn't having to fight the Russians anymore, they still had to park a million guys around to make sure they retain control. And these guys were desperately needed on the Western Front, right?
Yeah. And at the end of the series, we might entertain some what if questions, but what would have been the best outcome for Germany besides winning according to their original plan? If they would have stopped now and tried to arrange some sort of peace on the Western Front and kept all this territory, but that's practically an empire of Central and Eastern Europe right there. That is a lot of land. And
yes,
going to lose a whole lot at the end of the war, but really, in some sense, is a high watermark for them. And also what it means is that, I mean, yes, they do have a lot of territory they have to occupy. But another factor, and we're going to see how this plays out in the next episode, is that it frees up 40 German divisions to join the Western Front. So as an occupying force, they need soldiers for that. But with their resources as a fighting force, that can help support that theater of war. I mean, it's to the point that the French prime minister and the British prime minister thought that the Bolsheviks were, at this point, de facto allies of the Germans because they did so much to help them at this point. The Bolsheviks, they repudiated all debts of the Russians. The effect that has, at least for French investors, including financiers, is that what was several billion dollars of fortune is now in absolutely worthless czarist Russia government bonds that would have, that at the beginning of the war, it was something to cement ties between czarist Russia and the French Republic. That's all gone. So big, big change right there. Huge tectonic shift in Europe because of what happens in Russia.
Yeah, Germany goes from fighting a two-front war to a one-front war, and that's a lot easier. And I appreciated what you said, Scott, about the 40 divisions. I made it sound like Germany didn't have any benefit from the war ending, but even though they had to keep a million guys in the east to keep control over their newly conquered territories, it is true, you're absolutely right, that they were still able to send a lot of men back to the west. And we're going to see a little bit later that they are going to put those men to use immediately or almost immediately and really hit the Allies hard. But that's for another episode. So Russia lost a lot of territories, we've seen, but Lenin didn't mind, you know, because he said, you know, we'll get them back eventually. It's no big deal. Lenin was playing the long game. Lenin realized, he was smart enough to realize that we don't have to hold every inch of territory. We can give up a little now to consolidate our control over Russia. And then later on, when they're not looking, we'll just take it back. That's what communist states do, right?
Yeah, and I mean, for Lenin, part of his radicalism is that he is so much a dyed-in-the-wool true believer of communism. And he said that the goal of socialism in Russia wouldn't be realized without the success of a world proletariat uprising in other countries. And for a few years, there is a revolutionary wave that does last until about 1923 or so. Doesn't continue, so Russia doesn't have this worldwide uprising, but hey, they still have plenty of change, as we said at the beginning of this episode. All right, well, we mentioned what effect this has on the war with all those German troops going to the Western Front. And in the next episode, we're going to be returning there. We're going to be seeing what happens in the Third Battle of Ypres and how what the Allies thought was momentum shifting in their direction is going to be something else entirely. So we'll see you there. Well, I think that covers it. That's all I have for today's episode. First off, I'd like to thank History Unplugged's Spy Masters, which you can easily become, and I'll explain what that is after listing them off. They are, in no particular order, Baron Fraser, Chris C., David Santee, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Jake Harrington, Josh Reddick, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Michael from New York, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Rob from Chicago, Salvador Sanchez, Tom from Ohio, Moondoggy from Ohio, Bill Ivey, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars, WMWGuitars.com, Los, Sergeant Hooch, Sumo 41, and Willie from New Jersey. Now, having thanked my spy masters, I'd like to mention some ways you can get more involved with what I'm doing with History Unplugged. First, if you want to comment on the most recent episodes, you can check out the History Unplugged Facebook or YouTube page, which are video recordings of all the episodes, and they often come out before the audio episodes do. Second, please like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps the show grow and find new listeners. Finally, the best way you can get involved is to join History Unplugged's membership program called the Dalton's Rangers. This is the place where you can directly partner with me when it comes to the creation of the sorts of episodes I do, or I can most directly talk with you, the listener. I call it the Dalton's Rangers because they were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War. Go to patreon.com/unplugged, and you can join at three levels. Join at the Scout level, you'll get early access to all new episodes and completely ad-free episodes, and I have about 500 by now. Join at the Intelligence Officer level. You get all the same stuff as level one, and you also get premium episodes. I'm doing a series on the life of Audie Murphy, on Americans who fought in World War I for the French Foreign Legion, and another series on Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakota Badlands. I have about 50 or so of these episodes now. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you get all the things from the first two tiers. You get a shout out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get three hardcover books, and you can ask me a question on absolutely anything in history, and I will devote an entire episode to answering it. So check out all those bonuses by going to patreon.com/unplugged. Listeners, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and see you next time.